I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Simon Sebag Montefiore joins me now. The acclaimed and best-selling historian and author has just published a new novel, Red Sky at Noon, the third and final novel from his Moscow trilogy, set during an epic cavalry ride across the hot grasslands outside Stalingrad during World War II. It's gotten great notices. It features the character Benya Golden, a Jewish writer wrongly imprisoned in a gulag. He joins a battalion made up of Cossacks and convicts to fight the Nazis. I'll get Mr. Montefiore to tell us about his book and the themes discussed in it and throughout his work. His nonfiction books include Jerusalem, the biography, The Romanovs, and Young Stalin, among many others. Visit SimonSebagMontefiore.com or his Twitter handle, at Simon Montefiore. The new book is published by Pegasus Books. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in Toronto, Simon Montefiore. Mr. Montefiore, good morning.
Morning. How are you?
Pretty good yourself.
Yeah, great to be talking to you.
The same, the same. Did you write a novel at all before these nonfiction books that we know you for?
I've written fiction in between each of these nonfiction books.
I see.
And I actually started writing fiction first of all when I was just at university. So I really started as a fiction writer, and these books, Red Sky at Noon, being the new one, but mm-hmm. also the other two in the trilogy, Sashenka and One Night in Winter, are my sort of first love, if you like.
Yeah, and I guess the research that you did for the nonfiction, I mean, that obviously informs the setting, obviously, and the times in which these books are set, right?
Totally. I mean, obviously the history books are all about power and the court of great men, powerful men. The novels are more about love and private life and marriage, but they're also set against terror and war and in the most oppressive and repressive regimes in history, and all the history in them is accurate. All the details of Soviet society and the German army and the Russian army, for example, in this book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a war story. It's a war story. It's a love story. It's a thriller.
Yeah, I guess love stories don't really factor very much in especially war nonfiction. But you can write about that in a novel, right?
That's right. And that's a joy of it for me, because, as I said, you know, like when I wrote The Romanovs or my book on Jerusalem or my books on Stalin, they're really studies of power and they're quite grim. The redeeming thing in the novels is that they're really about love and about how love can redeem. But they are also twisting thrillers that really, I hope, capture what it was like to live in this sort of society, what it was like to be at war. And in this book, this peculiar war down in the Russian steppes in 1942.
So that's where the book begins, 1942.
Where the book is set, yeah.
And so where are we in the war? I mean, it's a very violent time, isn't it?
It's a terrible time. It's probably the most terrible time in all of human history, I think. Where we are in 1942 is a neglected place and part of the war, because it's the time when Hitler launches this huge offensive called Case Blue, which was designed to knock Russia out of the war. And it's across the Ukraine, across the southern steppes, towards the Don River, towards the Volga River. And the Russian army just disintegrates. And it's boiling summer, and it's prairies. It's like the steppes there are like prairies. They're like grasslands.
Mm-hmm.
They're like what you have in your great grain-growing provinces here in Canada and in the States. And there's real, it's horse territory, basically. And so the Germans start to use cavalry, and so do the Russians for different reasons. And so there you have, in these boiling hot grasslands in 1942, a terrible, vicious war, but also some of the last real cavalry battles in history.
Mm. Yeah, so we'll talk about horses in just a sec, but this character, Benya Golden, he's imprisoned. Why?
Well, he's imprisoned for nothing, like most of... He's a political prisoner in the gulag mm-hmm. at the beginning of the book. And the full story of why is in the earlier novel, Sashenka. But all you need to know for this book, which can be read totally on its own,
mm-hmm.
is that he's in prison for attempts assassinate Stalin and the whole Soviet leadership, which of course is complete rubbish. He's done nothing. All he did was fall in love with the wrong woman, and he's been sent to the Far East to die in the gold mines of in the Far East, in the most terrible of the concentration camps. And he, but when the war starts, he, as a Jew, as a Russian writer, as a patriot, he wants to fight. And the only way he can fight is to get a place in one of Stalin's punishment battalions, which are these battalions, really battalions of the damned, created by Stalin, full of criminals, Cossacks, cutthroats, murderers. And Stalin said that they can fight, but the only way they can redeem themselves is if they're wounded in battle. Otherwise, they go back to being prisoners again. And so these were kind of really brutal regiments, but also they were desperate to survive and to find a way to redeem themselves in the war. And Benya joins one of these, and they're trained as cavalry and sent in to attack the advancing Germans.
Now surely Benya knows that Stalin isn't a good guy. And so how does he manage to throw his lot in with them? I mean, he does realize what he's getting into, right?
What you say is a really good point, because at this time in the war, many Russians, many Cossacks, many Ukrainians, and many other of the Soviet people were all defecting and changing sides, and they all secretly hated Stalin all along. So you're absolutely right. But Benya's a Jew, so he hasn't. First of all, he hasn't got any choice. But secondly, he believes that the Russian side is the right side, is the better side in this terrible conflict of two evils in many ways. And but many of his comrades in the battalions of the damned do change sides, and so you never know who's going to defect, who's on your side. It's really a time of total chaos. The Holocaust is happening behind the German lines. Many of his comrades who are Cossacks are crossing to fight for the Germans. It's a confusing time, and it's a terrible time. And he's just about learned to ride, and he's with this gang of Cossacks, who many of whom secretly hate Stalin, of course. So you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah. Now, we forget that horses were used in the Second World War. And the extent to which is described in this book, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they had, I think that Stalin, even in 1942, he had something like 18 million horses trained for cavalry. So there were almost a million people fighting in cavalry, and most of them were down in this part of the world, in these hot grasslands. And so, you know, they had Kalmyks and other indigenous peoples descended from the Mongols as trackers and as scouts. On both sides, there were Cossacks working as scouts and as cavalry. And so, you know, I was brought up on those great American novels, Cormac McCarthy and Elmore Leonard, and Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry. And so something occurred to me that there was some parallel between these wars that they describe and which I'm describing. And so they are in some ways the inspiration. Novel.
Yeah, a number of the reviews likened Red Sky at Noon to a Western.
That's right. It's like a Western on the Eastern Front. Or somebody else said it's Cormac McCarthy with Nazis and Cossacks.
Right. Yeah. Now the relationship that Benya has with his horse, is there one in particular that he's fond of?
Yeah, he loves his horse called Silver Fox. And in cavalry, your horse is everything to you, and the difference between life and death. And you come to love your horse, and especially in his situation, where virtually all his family are probably dead. He's on his own. He's with this group of cutthroats who may at any point change sides. And so everything depends on his horse, Silver Fox, and he absolutely loves that horse. And Silver Fox is one of the great characters of the book.
Yeah. Now, Stalin and his daughter also are in the book. What are you able to gain, Simon, in terms of understanding, say, Russia in writing fiction as you do? Because you have this background, obviously, in writing nonfiction. But when you write about a character like Stalin in your novels, is there some understanding that you come away with?
Yeah, I mean, I think the irony is, I mean, if you want to, I believe strongly that if you want to know history, you read history books.
Mm-hmm.
But in my historical novels, they're very accurate. And in some ways, because I can imagine what Stalin is thinking to himself, which I would never do in my history books,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes in some ways these books are closer to what Stalin was really like. And by the way, Hitler's a character in this book as well, mm. later on. But the Stalin stuff is really accurate and really, I think, close to how he really was. And, of course, you mentioned the story with his daughter. In this book, as I said, it's a war and espionage thriller, but there are two love stories. And one is at the lowest ebb of society between a sort of, when Benya Golden becomes a prisoner of the Axis troops, a prisoner of the Italians. And the other is at the top of Soviet society, the leader's own daughter, Svetlana. And that story is very accurate to what really happened. She really did have a love affair with a 40-year-old writer,
mm.
and she was 16. So, their affair was, of course, discovered by the secret police. Stalin was furious. And the denouement, which is described in the book, is entirely accurate of what really happened.
Now, I hate to ask this question, but I'm sure you're asked this as you're touring the world talking about this book, but is there one that you enjoy writing more than the other, say, whether it's fiction?
Everyone else, but actually, the truth is, I enjoy writing the novels much more because, I put my soul, I put a lot of myself into the book, and as I say, I think for every writer, really, writing about power is a great thing, but writing the great questions of love and family, marriage, adultery, these are the great subjects for fiction, I think. And so I love writing about those. And I love reaching other readers, And one of the joys of this is that there are a lot of people that will never read my history books, but will read the fiction and love the fiction. And they're now in something like 27 or 30 languages, these novels. So they're gradually, now that the trilogy is going to be complete and the other two novels are going to be out soon and available soon as well, they're all going to be together in one edition and in one from one publisher, and that's going to be lovely and really, really satisfactory for me.
Did you learn anything about yourself writing novels, say?
I think you do. I think you learn a lot. And also, you get very involved with these characters. I mean, I've written three books now with Benya in them, and these characters are very familiar to me. And you weep when terrible things happen, and you're delighted when they're surviving, when they're escaping, when they're flourishing. And so, yes, I mean, and of course, another interesting thing I think about writing these books is, yes, they're novels set in World War II and in the 30s and in Russia, but really, many novelists write about, these subjects, children and marriage and family and love and adultery, but mainly they're set in contemporary times in a suburb of Vancouver or Toronto or Hampstead in London.
Mm-hmm.
But if you set them in these desperate times, the most desperate wars and terror, it adds a double jeopardy to what are ordinary situations. So in these books, people are married and they have love affairs and they have children and they worry about their husbands and so on. These are things that we all know and understand, but they are placed in Russia in 1942 in a desperate war of annihilation between two terrible dictators. And so that adds a whole nother aspect to this war story.
And setting them where you do and when you do can be instructive
exactly.
to our times, can't they?
They can be. I mean, we're living in times when, autocracy is again rising, when Russia is suddenly a real subject of fascination for us. And in fact, people are ringing me up and asking me to do interviews on Russia, on the Romanovs, on my other book on Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. At the moment. So it's a real time of people are suddenly fascinated by the history as well. And that's very interesting. And so I'm doing a lot of talking about that as well.
And so when I'm sure you're asked about the current political situation with this president and a connection with Russia. Because of your study of history, can you see patterns, and can you see how our time, where our story, sort of how that resolves itself later?
I can't see resolution. After all, no one, even the Russians, who were kind of undermining Hillary Clinton's campaign, but even the Russian intelligence didn't expect Trump to actually win. Because, of course, the Russian intelligence always presumes that all American presidential elections are fixed by the establishment. So they were amazed when Trump, the anti-establishment candidate, actually won. And they were delighted at first, and then, of course, they panicked. As for President Putin, you know, his main interest in the West is to undermine confidence and legitimacy in Western democracies. That's what he wants to do, because any weakness in the Western democracies is a chance for Russia to return to its historical position as one of the great powers of the world. As for Trump, I think his fascination with Putin is partly a contempt for democracy, and I also think it's partly psychological, a sort of boy crush on a sort of swaggering gangster boss like autocrat, the kind of guy Donald Trump has always wanted to be. And I think thirdly, you know, he really admires the fact that Donald Trump has, and that Putin has such absolute power. And I think, you know, Trump really wants to be the first American czar.
Now, back to the character of Benya, because he's been in these three novels.
Yes.
And he's obviously someone that you have affection for. How much, I'm sure you're asked this too, as you're touring with this book, how much of yourself is in him?
Well, a lot of people ask me that, actually. And he is the hero of the book. But I think there's just as much of me in the leading women characters as there are in the men, actually. And you know, I think all novelists put a bit of themselves into their leading characters. So, you know, there's a great female character in this novel too, called Fabiana, the Italian nurse, and she's a sort of wonderful lover of culture and literature and poetry, and so there's something of me and her too. But, and of course then there's Benya, and then there's Stalin's most trusted comrade in arms, Satanov, and there's something of me and him too. So there's always a bit of the novelist in many of these characters, but not in the horrible villains, of course.
But so as this trilogy closes, as you publish the third in this series, is it a melancholy time that these characters are no longer same?
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange time for me, because it's the end of an era, really, because I've been writing these novels for more than since 2008, and so for 10 years basically I've been writing this trilogy in between history books, and so now that the trilogy is over, so for 10 years I've been living with Benya and these characters, and I think the women characters in these books are very strong as well, and lots of readers write to me about the female characters, and some of them have even sent me paintings of the leading female characters, and they've painted them absolutely beautifully, just as I imagined them, which is so extraordinary.
Right. Yeah, it must be fun that your readers can see them as you do.
Yes, and I think that. They're now I'm just negotiating with a movie studio, movie production company, to buy, to start to develop the trilogy as a TV drama series of the sort that we all now love and watch. So that's really exciting as well.
Yeah. Well, when you write a novel like this, do you take on the habits of writers that you've read and admired? You mentioned three of the American writers in the Western genre.
Especially in the Western genre. I mean, of course, one's aware. For example, there are seven riders that set out in the prologue of the novel, and of course that's a wink at the Western that we know and love, and
right.
Seven and that sort of thing on horseback. And but one tries not to one can't take that too far. They're in Russia, 1942. It's a nonetheless, one does take on, one tries to learn from those masters, and not just those three, but others too, but one tries to learn from the masters, of course, how they did it, because that's the art of writing, is reading other great books and learning from them and studying them, and that's the joy of literature, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, in terms of writing the novels as opposed to the nonfiction, do you write differently? Are you situated in a different spot or on a different device? Like, do you use pen,
yes,
paper?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I have a great office in my house in London, but, of course, I have to be there when I'm writing my history books, because all my notes are, you know, there, and for the history books, which, as you know, a huge volume.
Right.
There's a vast amount of sort of books and notes I have to have near me, so I'm stuck there. But with these books, I can go down to my country place, I can write it. I'm in Toronto now in a lovely hotel. I'll probably do some writing tomorrow.
Uh-huh.
So that's a great joy that I can write, and now I can write my stuff anywhere when I'm writing fiction. And so that's very liberating. So yeah, I write it everywhere.
Now, the interest for the novels in particular, is there a difference between that in Europe as opposed to, say, here on this side of the Atlantic?
I think that in Europe, the novels, in some countries in Europe, they're really successful and well-known. Like, for example, in Poland and Romania, for example, and Albania. And so in some sort of quite surprising countries, the novels are really, really into the real following for them, in Holland as well, and in England as well. So I think that in America they're going to become really well known when they're all united under one in one set, which is going to be really exciting, which is going to happen this year.
Now, you're obviously a very busy writer because you have various projects and the sort. Is there something that you're working on now?
Well, at the moment I'm doing all sorts of different things. I've got a lot of movie projects,
mm-hmm.
which is really exciting. There's someone making a movie of young Stalin. There's someone making a movie. Angelina Jolie is making a movie of Catherine the Great and Potemkin. And 20th Century Fox are making an animated movie of the children's book I've written with my wife, Santa Montefiore,
mm-hmm.
which is called The Royal Rabbits of London. So, yeah, a lot of crazy stuff going on, which is all really satisfying and fun and refreshing, and I always wanted to have a sort of multimedia writing life.
And I guess that's so that's sort of expected of writers nowadays, isn't it?
Well, I think that, you know, these TV drama series really are like the great episodic novels of old, you know, Tolstoy,
mm-hmm.
Dickens, people like that, were all published, Balzac, were all published in installments in magazines, which sold millions of copies each week or each month. And I think that the writing for these big TV dramas on Netflix and HBO are the equivalent of that as well. So I think, yeah, I think all writers are very interested in that, and I'm now starting to write, this year, funny enough, I'm starting to write scripts independently of books, which is really exciting and a new experience for me. And I think a lot of writers are doing that now, and I think it's really a fun thing for us to do.
So it is enjoyable to write differently, say,
yes,
than you're used to.
Yes, I think it is different. And also, I'm very involved in all the sort of drama, the development of all my, all my books are now involved in these deals, either feature films or drama series of the type that are on HBO and Netflix.
Yeah.
So all of them are being developed, and I just hope that some of them. They say that if you have about 10 in development, you get about 3 made. Well, I have about 10, so. So I think this year some of them will definitely get made, which is going to be really exciting.
And so, do you enjoy that process of say having to? Well, you are involved to a certain extent, but just how involved are you in terms of how, say, even the characters look as opposed to how you might have imagined them in your head?
Some of them more than less. I mean, virtually all of them. I'm an executive producer, so I will have a say in stuff. And I've deliberately not tried to write them because. because I'm an inexperienced scriptwriter, I didn't want to delay them happening. Mm-hmm. So I deliberately wanted the experts to do it. But actually, experts are finding them difficult to develop. So in the end, maybe I will write them as well. But that's why I'm really keen not to rewrite stuff I've already done, but to write completely new material for TV, and that's what I'm doing at the moment.
One of the things that I've in learning about you and having seen you on television over the years, in interviews and the sort of, is because you have so many projects, whether they be fiction, nonfiction, and now in film and television. Is just how prolific you are, but how you, and I've always wondered this, how you're able to keep your stamina going, and is there a trick, is there a secret, say, to how you're able to maintain the output that you have?
I think the key thing is to immerse yourself in each thing you do, and I think this is true of all successful writers. Everything they do, they can do lots of things, but they immerse themselves in it completely. And also, I only write things I really love doing, mm-hmm. and that makes a big difference too. Because I think this is true of many writers. I mean, you immerse yourself in something and you're passionate about it, and that tells. But the other thing for writers is, we're always so grateful. Even now, after all these years, I'm still grateful that I'm sort of making a living from it, yet alone doing, and that it's a bit like being an, I think actors are the same.
Mm-hmm.
I think actors and writers are always pretty grateful that they're in work, as it were. And so one doesn't want to stop, one wants to keep going.
And the other thing that I've also admired about you is that you're such a good reader as well, while you write, and a consumer of film.
Yeah, I mean, thank you, but I love other people's books, and I read a lot of stuff, and I try and help other people. I'm always trying to sort of help other people if I can, encourage people, and et cetera, et cetera. And if I read something really good, I put it on my Instagram page, or I'm always recommending great books, because I think we're all in that world, where we want to encourage excellence in the arts, and that's something I'm always trying to do.
And reading is vital to writing, isn't it?
Yeah, and reading is vital to reading is vital to writing, but reading is also vital to life and to enjoying life. And I'm trying to teach my children to read and enjoy reading.
It's been such a pleasure speaking with you today. I appreciate your time.
Really nice to talk to you, and thanks for a really enjoyable conversation.
The book is called Red Sky at Noon. It's published by Pegasus Books. Its author, Simon C. Bagmontiofori, joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunta.